Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking with the author of a brand new book, The Age of American Unreason, making a strong argument about the state of American political, intellectual, and social culture today. But before we go to our author in today's program, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
For several years, the Federal Communications Commission has been under fire from public interest groups to provide better information about broadband access in America. The groups argue that without specific data on speeds and locations of broadband access, there can be no effective public broadband policy. The FCC should abide by its congressional mandate to create broadband policy that allows Internet users to download and upload high-quality video content. S. Derek Turner, Research Director for Free Press, explains.
Congress at the time was very much aware that the power of broadband is not in its ability to deliver content from multinational big corporate content providers. The power that broadband has lies in its ability as a communications medium for people to communicate with one another. And so this is why Congress put specific emphasis on the issue of users having the ability to originate content as well as receive content.
It seems the FCC is beginning to take its job seriously. Last week, the agency published sweeping changes to its data collection processes. Turner says that up to now, high speed referred to anything that wasn't dial-up. The new definition is not fast enough, he says, but it's a start.
They've moved it from 200 kilobits per second to 768 kilobits per second, or about the speed of an entry-level DSL.
To measure broadband adoption, the agency has been using a method that counts by zip codes. That means if one person in a zip code had a satellite broadband connection, the entire geographic area covered by that code was counted.
So what they're doing now is actually requiring providers to list the number of subscribers at the census tract level. And the census tract level basically corresponds to, in some cases, five or six city blocks.
Turner says that data collection can sometimes seem esoteric and wonky, but these changes to FCC policy will have a direct effect on Internet users.
For almost 10 years now, we've relied on very poor data gathering that basically hid the true state of the marketplace. But with this action, this FCC has engaged in one of those rare instances where they listened to reason, they listened to logic, and they actually acted in the public interest and essentially ignored a lot of the crowing from the narrow private interest, narrow special interest. And we actually have made good policy. So everyday Americans should care about this because hopefully this data will be used to bring them a truly competitive broadband marketplace where they're getting great connections that are very fast and they're getting them at an affordable rate.
As president and CEO of Clergy Strategic Alliances, Reverend Ramal Toon travels the country training churches on voter registration, issue education, and how to build justice ministries through effective national and local coalitions. Reverend Toon brought his message of collaboration and unity to the National Conference for Media Reform in Minneapolis. We can achieve far more through unity, he says, than we can ever achieve on our own.
Unity. Unity allows us to accept that even though we come from different places, have different agendas, different goals, and different ways to bring about change, all of us are trying to get to a similar place that makes life better for the people we serve. Unity. Unity allows us to say that even though there are times when we may not agree, we are still on the same side. And I will stand with you in the fight to achieve our dreams. Because the greatest gift we have in the pursuit of change is each other. You see, obstacles are the things you see when you take your eyes off your goals. And whenever we find ourselves debating over which organization's logo was not included on a flyer, whenever we find ourselves engaging in the politics of this organization getting more money than that organization, whenever we find ourselves arguing over the speaking order at a press conference, we must be mindful of the harsh reality that tonight across this country, there are children who will sleep on city streets. Every 3 hours, a child will die through to gun violence. Families will struggle to put food on the table. And these are the people who are waiting for us to show up and demand power for the powerless. They are the reason. They are the reason why failure is not an option. Somebody say unity.
To listen to Reverend Ramal Toon's entire speech and others from the National Conference for Media Reform, go to freepress.net/conference.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure today to have as our guest and author of a brand new book, The Age of American Unreason, just published by Pantheon. Susan Jacoby, the author, is joining us, and she's the author of several previous books, seven to be exact, and this is her latest, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Well, I'm glad to be back on this program again.
You were on this before.
I think I was on it when Free Thinkers was published.
Well, your memory is better than mine then. And well, I have read your book, and it's a real delight, and I'm planning to use it in my class this coming year. So lots of my students will probably be listening to this interview down the road. Why did you...
you mean forced to listen to
No, hardly. They'll probably cram for the exams. Why did you decide to write this book?
That's a complicated question. There's a story that's not in the book, and I didn't put it in the book because it sounds like it's made up, but I have used it in a lot of interviews because it's true. And when I tell you about it, you'll see why it sounds made up. It was on September 11th, 2001, and I had been working on another book in the New York Public Library, and like most New Yorkers, I had to walk home for miles that day because the subways weren't running. And like a lot of New Yorkers, I suspect, I stopped in a bar for a drink. I really needed one. And there were two fellows with briefcases, suits, you know, expensive shoes, the whole thing. In their early 30s, I'd say. Good jobs. And one of them said, "This must be what Pearl Harbor felt like." And I thought, well, yeah, that sounds about right. And the other one said, "What's Pearl Harbor?" And the first one replied, "Pearl Harbor is when the Vietnamese bombed one of our harbors and started the Vietnam War." And I thought, oh. I thought, really, you see why it sounds made up.
Yeah.
And I can't say that a cartoon light bulb dawned over my head, but I did think, you know, there's something here. There's something wrong here. I need to file this away in my head and come back to it later.
And if you had a working thesis then, you were basically concerned with understanding and explaining the state of the shallowness or the stupidity, pick your word.
Well, simply that Americans don't know what they ought to. Like, and it's something really I've been thinking about. I'm of the 60s generation. And I think that there was a general assumption. Yeah, it's been an American culture all along, but I think certainly after World War II, those of us who were born after the war and who were raised in that post-war era, that each generation was going to know more than the next. Each generation was going to be better educated than the next. And I don't think in my adult lifetime that has proved to be true for a lot of reasons that I go into in the book. We are indeed going to school for many more years than our parents and grandparents did, but the general level of American culture and knowledge is not what it ought to be.
And what is your background that you bring to bear for this book?
I read and I write.
Well, you're a longstanding journalist, I guess, is the point I'm getting at.
I read and I write about a lot of things, and I've been doing it my entire adult life.
Mm-hmm. But you've been a working journalist, too, for many years.
Yes, but mostly I've written books. I consider myself a historian now, not a journalist, but I started out as a reporter for The Washington Post, and I covered education for The Post in the late 1960s, which I think maybe was the start of my interest in all of this. education, as you will recall, was a very hot story then. There was something happening on college campuses every day. I became very interested in education in general as a result of that job, certainly.
And in the book, Susan Jacoby, The Age of American Unreason, that we're talking about, in the book you do a nice job of really bringing a historical perspective on your argument. I mean, it's not, there are a lot of books that talk about the dumbing down of Americans today, and I think overlap years in a lot of respects in terms of the critique of where we're at today and the role of media in education systems. But your book really goes deep into American history to sort of bring forward your argument. And you invoke early in the book and return to on a couple of occasions Richard Hofstadter's work on anti-intellectualism in American life. For some of our listeners unfamiliar with that essay, could you explain what it was and why it's important?
Yes. Well, Richard Hofstadter's work called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life is one of the great historians of mid-century of the same generation as Arthur Schlesinger Jr., although Hofstadter died young in his late 50s. As he says, and it's true, you can't say that anti-intellectualism or anti-rationalism are something new. When his book was published in 1963, he talked about a number of factors that have been present since the dawn of the Republic, really, and they're mainly conflicts. He saw anti-intellectualism in many respects as in the flip side of some of America's better impulses, such as religious fundamentalism is fundamentally anti-rational in that fundamentalists believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. That has been with us since the dawn of the Republic, and it's always been in conflict with more intellectual, rational forms of religion, again, since the dawn of the Republic. The bad side of fundamentalism in terms of rationalism is that it's irrational. You can't, for example, believe that the earth was created in 6 days and accept modern science. You can, however, be religious and accept modern science if it's not a literal form of religion. But that's the flip side of that kind of fundamentalist religion. Also, believed in a personal relationship between man and God and rejected ecclesiastical hierarchy. That was the good side of that kind of religion. Secondly, education. No country's ever had more faith in education than America as a source of getting a better job. No country ever democratized education as early as America. But on the other side of that, no country has ever been more suspicious of too much education than America. We like a certain kind of education, an education that has obvious, immediate, practical benefits. But we've always been a little suspicious of education for its own sake, as in the phrase, you know, too smart for his own good. Dwight Eisenhower famously said, an intellectual is a man who takes more words than he needs to tell more than he knows, that kind of thing. But what Hofstadter doesn't write about in his book, because he couldn't, because it was published in 1963, was the whole factor of the media as it's evolved throughout the past 40 years. The domination of the print culture by the video culture, this is something new that has been added to traditional American anti-intellectualism. And also, then there's another thing, too, which is certain factors in anti-intellectualism, such as fundamentalist religion, they're not really stronger today than they were. They're more politically powerful, but there aren't, the percentage of Americans who are fundamentalists is no larger than it ever was. But the difference between religious fundamentalism and the sum of human knowledge today, it's much greater than it was in America 100 years ago, so that the dissonance between those two things is greater.
Susan Jacoby, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. Susan Jacoby, author of the brand new book, The Age of American Unreason, just published by Pantheon out of New York. It's my pleasure to be speaking with her. We pre-taped this show, so don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Susan Jacoby, you invoke the name early on in the book, related to your critique of media, of Neil Postman. The late Neil Postman of New York University wrote the iconic book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which argued in effect, and I'm probably bastardizing slightly, that television, when it became the dominant medium in the United States, undermined what the great things print culture had done for our culture and our politics and our religion, for that matter, and sort of brought, crudely put, a dumbing down of the American people and a flabbiness to our minds. Your book, you say, is in this vein?
Neil's book was published in 1987, and it's called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is a great title. And it's a very prescient book in this respect. He was really only talking about television. And I think that most of what he said in that book is absolutely true, but much more so today, because 1987, it seems impossible to remember now, but it was before the era of personal computers and the dimension of 24/7 video entertainment that not only PCs, but that all of the portable entertainment devices we have now have added to our lives. In other words, things are much more, it was still then. In 1987, you still had to sort of plant yourself in one place to get this entertainment. Now, if you want to, and a lot of people want to, you can have your ears filled with noise or your eyes filled with video images 24/7. And that wasn't true then. So that what he said is true, only it's more true. And don't misunderstand me. One of the things about Neil Postman's book that's interesting is he mentions in there, and it's very true, and those of us who were young in the era of young TV can remember it, intellectuals had great hopes for television in the 1950s. Television was going to be this great educational media. It was going to bring the classics of the universe to everyone. Really, really, intellectuals embraced the idea of television as a force for good as much as anybody else did. What people didn't realize is how quickly the lowest common denominator would come to define things, and that people know they weren't going to be choosing to watch Shakespeare on television. And here we are now, you know, in the era of reality TV. And the same thing is true for computers, and it is true. Computers can be great educational tools. That's the great side of computers. Who in our business could possibly attack computers per se? The problem comes in when computers spread junk as much as anything else. The proportion of people watching kids beating each other up on YouTube or divorcing couples airing their dirty linen on YouTube, that gets a lot more hits than the educational things on computers. So that what the computer does is it makes more possible what the video culture already did. And I'm not saying, also, I don't think, I'm not one of these people who thinks that parents should raise their kids never to look at TV. Obviously we all need computers. We live in the world in which we live. The problem is when these things come to dominate all of our time so that we don't do anything else. And that increasingly is what's happening. This shocking survey released by the National Endowment for the Arts at the beginning of this year showed that half of people under the age of 40 didn't read any book last year that wasn't required for school. And by any book, I mean any book. I don't mean that they weren't reading War and Peace. I mean they weren't reading a mystery novel. They weren't reading a bodice ripper novel. They weren't reading a self-help book.
How about a graphic novel or a comic book?
I don't know whether they asked about graphic novels or comic books.
Okay.
I don't know about that, but any book, period. That's a really shocking thing. And if you are spending, as young men from 18 to 25 do, 3 hours a day playing video games, of course you're not reading a book. You can't do both of those things. So it's a matter of how much time we spend on one thing versus another, not the idea that one thing is all bad and the other thing is all good.
Susan Jacoby, you know, Neil Postman's been criticized since the book was written, Amusing Ourselves to Death, on the grounds that, well, he might have been accurate about television because that's a passive medium where people sort of sit there and veg out in front of it. With the computer, people are active. With video games, people are active. It is interactive. The brain does have to fire up a little more energy to be effective using those technologies. So the Postman critique no longer holds. What do you make of that?
I don't agree with that. First of all, of course, there's all kinds of interactive stuff on the internet. Internet, and video games are among them. And there are some very sophisticated video games. But what I'm talking about is not just brain exercise. Obviously, playing a video game requires more brain exercise than sitting back and watching the Beverly Hillbillies, although the content of a lot of them is no better. But the thing is that if you don't do anything else, video games are very self-referential. They have built-in in-game rewards. That's part of what they do. People become very obsessed with them. I think addictive is the right word. It's why people spend so much time playing them. But the most important thing is that interactive can have several meanings. Yes, playing video games is better than sitting on your butt on the couch. Of course, you can do both, actually. You can play a video game and sit on the couch. But what everybody does is they take the greatest example of what a medium has to offer and act as though that's what most people are doing for it. We know that the vast majority of people, what they're doing with digital things is passive entertainment. It's not, and not that I accept the idea that video games are a great thing. Again, I think they're a great thing in moderation. But doing anything like that, which requires basically looking at noise in self-referential world for hours and hours a day and doing nothing else, it doesn't mean you're learning anything. It's taking away from time in which you provide a framework of knowledge which can help make sense of everything, including video games. And let's talk more about the Internet as such. One of the more trenchant criticisms of what I'm saying you could make is this, and it has been made, that people like me explore the explosion of reading that's taken place on the Internet. Why worry about silly old books when people are reading so much on the Internet? I would argue that what we're doing on the Internet is not really reading at all in the traditional sense. I don't know about you. How many times a day do I use the Internet? How happy I am that I don't have to look through 10 books to find out some date I've forgotten or the name of the spelling of a country. But that isn't reading. It's swooping down like a vulture for bits of information. And that kind of information is useless if it doesn't fit into a broader body of knowledge. I'll give you an example. I often cite in my speeches, I'll say that, for example, a third of Americans can't name any First Amendment rights, not one. And a young man stood up at one of my lectures. It was actually in Illinois. It was a lecture at a small college in Illinois. And he stood up and he said, that's an elitist position. You don't need to know all of the rights in the First Amendment. You can look it up on the Internet. Well, that's true. But if you don't know that the First Amendment exists and what it means in terms of our history and our Constitution, you don't even think of looking up the rights in the First Amendment. There's my point, which is that you can't look things up on the Internet if you don't have any idea of what you're looking for.
Yeah, that's right. Susan Jacoby, one thing as I was reading your book and now listening to you that occurred to me was when your critique of media, I was wondering how much do you think that media operate in the manner they do due to just the technology and sort of what they are, the essence of the wires and tubes, as Ted Stevens would put it, or that it's due to sort of the institutional structures, the profit motivation, and especially the advertising and hyper-commercialism that permeates our media culture?
Well, it's very circular, isn't it? I mean, what the media will tell you about why they do the programs they do is that people like them, and that's true. Reality TV wouldn't be on if it didn't have high ratings. So it's a kind of circular thing in which people watch certain things more than others. The media offers more of that because advertisers will pay more for it, but it reduces what you're exposed to in general. Certainly, the profit motive is a part of everything. But it's really hard to tell the chicken from the egg in this thing. Whether the media is offering just what it's absolutely convinced people want, or whether people want it because that's all that's offered them, it's really hard to tell.
Our guest is Susan Jacoby. She is the author of The Age of American Unreason, just published by Pantheon this year. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Please recall that this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it shortly before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let us do the yakking. Susan Jacoby, in your book, I want very much to get to the last few chapters where you bring together your critique of the current period. But before we get to that, I do want to work through some of the history because I found it really useful and enlightening. On one hand, it seems like, you know, the founders of the Republic and the early Republic, as I read your book, can only be regarded as extraordinary intellectuals. And that period, in many respects, had a fairly vibrant public life, especially by comparison to today.
Well, first of all, the word intellectual wasn't used then. It's a late 19th century word. But yeah, they were, in terms of they were the most elite educated members of their society. Obviously, not as many people could read. In terms of a proportion of the population, not as many people could read in the 18th century as can read today. But there was, among the reading public, which was expanding very rapidly at the time of the Revolution, it was a very important part of the Revolution, reading the pamphlets of Thomas Paine and so on. The Revolution might very well not have happened without the expansion of reading that took place in the second half of the 18th century in the colonies that became the states. But there was a very vibrant intellectual life, and everybody who could read everything they could get their hands on then, which was a lot less than they could get their hands on today.
And then in the first half of the 19th century, one of the interesting things in your book, which I makes perfect sense to me, but I never really thought about, was that you saw a real regional diversity, that's not really the right word, difference is a better word, in how literacy and print culture developed in the northern states from the southern states.
Well, that's important, and it remains important today in terms of attitudes about elitists and intellectual values. It's not, and this is not any original argument with me, but it's often not stressed enough. What happened very simply in America after the Constitution and at the beginning of the 19th century was this: slavery was the chief thing that was responsible for the intellectual division between the North and the South. Public education expanded in the North, especially in New England, but also in the Middle Atlantic states, and later in the states of the Upper Midwest, which were settled by New Englanders going west looking for more land. But what happened in the South is that a system of common schools, which is what public schools were then, never really got off the ground in the South because, obviously, you weren't going to teach blacks anyway, who were in many of the deep South states, were the majority of the population. But also, because this is a slavery-based economy, it's run by a planter class. And the planter class was not interested in educating poor whites either. And poor whites weren't interested in education in the same way that immigrants who kept arriving up north were, because there wasn't any real social mobility in the slavery economy-based states. Whereas the difference between reading and not reading in the north, in a northern city, could make a real difference in the kind of job you had. It didn't make that much difference in the south because you have a cotton-based, slavery-based economy there, and not a whole lot of opportunity for poor whites, and obviously none for black slaves. And you have in the South, you know, where the reading culture in the South was confined to the planter class, some of which sent its kids up north, others of which, Thomas Jefferson's University of Virginia was meant to be for the education of the aristocracy. And it wasn't. Thomas Jefferson, by the way, believed in public education, but it never happened in his state. And one of the reasons that it didn't happen the way it did in the North was the slavery economy. So there's the beginning of a big difference. Even today in the South, the proportion of high school graduates in the Deep South is much lower than it is anywhere else in the country. The proportion of college graduates is much lower than it is anywhere in the country. One of the things that actually revealed this in a graphic way recently was Hurricane Katrina, in which the sad state of the schools in the city of New Orleans and the incredibly high dropout rate in the city of New Orleans was flashed about for all to see. There isn't any northern city that has schools in any way with as abysmal achievement and completion rates as New Orleans, Louisiana. And that's something nobody likes to talk about. It's also true that religious fundamentalism is much stronger in the Deep South than it is anywhere else in the country. And there is, nobody likes to hear this, but there is a direct correlation between fundamentalism and lack of education. The less education Americans have, the more likely they are to be fundamentalists. And I stress, I'm not saying religious. Religion and religious fundamentalism are two different things. There are all kinds of religious people in this country, the majority, who are not fundamentalists. But fundamentalism, which insists on a literal interpretation of the Bible, is a phenomenon intimately linked with poor education, with low educational levels, and that is the South still in relation to the North.
Susan Jacoby, in your book, The Age of American Unreason, you argue that the Red Scare went a long way towards tarring intellectuals as being people that regular Americans should be suspicious of. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, let's jump a little bit ahead.
Okay.
The Red Scare was after World War One.
Okay, right through into the
really,
McCarthy era.
Really, I think the McCarthy era after World War II did, and for a very simple reason, that intellectuals were more attracted to communism in the 1930s than any other group in American society for a whole variety of reasons that I don't think we have the time to go into. But it is a fact that while most intellectuals were not communists, as a group, intellectuals were much more attracted to all forms of left-wing politics than any other group in American society. So when the post-World War II investigations of communists came along, a lot of the people sitting in the witness chair were intellectuals. They were people who had been writers, and they were people who were screenwriters. You could ask how intellectual they were. There were a lot of people who were either no longer communists or maybe never had been, but maybe they'd had some sympathy in the 1930s with communism. There were a lot of reasons for that in the 1930s. People saw a lot of what they called eggheads sitting in witness chairs at congressional committee hearings, so that intellectualism became somewhat tarred with pinkoism then. And it is based on a reality, which is that intellectuals in the 1930s were more attracted to communism than were other groups in American society.
Our guest, Susan Jacoby, author of the...
Though not overwhelmingly.
Okay, the author of The Age of American Unreason. Again, pre-recorded show. Please don't call in. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. And now let's really get to the heart and soul of the book, which I think is the last 40 or 50 years. And you talk in the book about middlebrow culture from the 50s and 60s, the period in which you grew up and which I confess I grew up in. And
it's all right. it's okay.
When some of your, and I suspect the term is unfamiliar to some of our listeners, I'd like you to explain what you mean by middlebrow culture and, you know, what its strengths were and what we've lost by its passing.
Okay, yes, you're right. Middlebrow culture is a term that's not very familiar to Americans today because it's dead. Middlebrow culture actually was much disdained by intellectuals. What middlebrow culture was, and many of your listeners will remember this era, it was the culture of the Book of the Month Club, of encyclopedias, of people wanting all things educational for their children. It has a long history in this country. It started out with public lecture series called Lyceums in the 19th century. And the heart of middlebrow culture was reading. And who knows how many sets of encyclopedias were sold between 1920 and 1960. And they were sold, often they were sold to parents who themselves had not had the opportunity of an education. It was a symbol of the something better they wanted to give their kids. Middlebrow culture also is sort of novels by the pound. My family belonged to the Book of the Month Club. You know, some of the novels I read when I was a kid were things like James Michener's Hawaii, other books, Howard Fast Spartacus, which wasn't a book of the month club because he was at that time, he was a communist. Now he's an anti-communist. Citizen Tom Paine, also by Howard Fast. Later on, going on to other novels, which were in the early 60s, Kurt Vonnegut's Catch-22 was mentioned in the Book of the Month Club News, Michener's Sayonara, a whole potpourri of a lot of novels, good, bad, and indifferent, all of them having one thing in common. They were very long. People took on 800-page novels like they wanted to get their money's worth. And this kind of culture, this culture of reading and writing for commercial appeal, was very much disdained by intellectuals. But I think what intellectuals missed at that time, and they were called highbrow intellectuals, what they missed was is that reading wasn't an end point. It was a beginning point. It was an entrance door to something else. Also, part of middlebrow culture was something that wasn't part of my upbringing, but it was part of a lot of kids I knew who grew up in Jewish and Italian-American homes. Weekly Saturday broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera. I have so many friends who remember that as a feature of their childhood. In other words, great music, great books, certified, yes, by experts who advised you on it, but it exposed people to things which were at a much higher level than the garbage that we get today 24/7 is. And it's not, by the way, that all of those things aren't available in niche markets now. It's that they're not the standard for the culture.
Alan Bloom, the conservative commentator, writer, critic, wrote a book, it must be two decades ago now, making an argument that's similar to yours, with differences, of course, but his emphasis was that it was the 60s generation of the hippies and the left-wingers who had no respect for culture and tradition, who really were the reason why we've seen not just middlebrow, but highbrow culture collapse in the United States. What's your take on that critique?
Alan Bloom was of the blame everything on the 60s school. I mean, it's really fascinating, people like that, they talked about the collapse of everything, and they managed to make a great living as professors at universities all of those years. But I do, in one sense, buy what Alan Bloom says, in that I think that the adults on both the left and the right in the 60s and the early 70s in the universities abandoned their responsibility to uphold certain standards. What's wrong with Alan Bloom's argument is not that he says that everybody should be taught a lot about traditional Western culture. What's wrong with his argument is he says there was no worth in teaching anybody about African American history or literature by women either. Now, that's my quarrel with the Alan Bloom thing. My quarrel with the academic left of the late 60s and early 70s, and it wasn't the students, it was the professors at the time, is that they did this. Instead of what should have been done is that all of this that had been neglected. When I graduated from college in 1965, I'd never read a word of W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the greatest thinkers this country has ever produced, never read a line of poetry by Langston Hughes. Those things belong in American literature courses, in American history courses, in economics course. They don't belong off in some black studies ghetto where only mainly black students are going to learn them. They belong in part of our general core curriculum. And, of course, people who want to go on to graduate school can get the specialized stuff. But what happened, in my view, and I covered this as a reporter, on campuses in the early 70s was this. The left and the right made a bargain. The bargain that was made on campuses was we're going to create all these separate multicultural studies departments, and there are going to be a lot of new tenured jobs for you people. The left like that. Meanwhile, the people on the right, like Alan Bloom, who had nothing but contempt for anything that might be taught in an African studies course or a women's studies course, got to go on teaching their course, courses the way they used to, which was just really about white guys. I'll give you an example. This is not true on every campus. There has been a reaction, and some campuses have integrated more of this material into the core curriculum. I was lecturing at a university in Southern California a few years ago, And a great book had just come out. It's called Mirror to America. It's by the great African-American historian John Hope Franklin, born in 1915, still alive. And it was a unique book in that it was almost a history of race in the 20th century viewed through the eyes of an African-American who is also an eminent professional historian, a rare thing. This is a great book, and I mentioned it in what I was talking about. And a Vietnamese student came up to me afterwards and said, yes, she knew about this book. It was wonderful. She'd read it in her African-American history course. I said, oh? I said, were there any white students in the class? And she said, no. She said, the only two non-black students were her and another kid from Taiwan. Now, that book, Mirror to America, and that kind of book belongs in an American history class, not just in an African-American history class where it's ghettoized and all students won't be exposed to it.
One of the things that's been striking, Susan Jacoby, to me, and not as much today as it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago, is when Soviet dissidents or artists would leave the Soviet Union and come to the West, and they'd revel in the freedoms they had in the United States or in Western Europe. But they would almost always comment at some point when they felt comfortable on how atrocious the educational system was and how weak the overall culture was, even by comparison to the sort of the communist land they had left. And you describe in your book a very interesting discussion of how, for personal reasons, you actually left the United States for a couple of years in the late 60s, early 70s, and so you were completely cut off from American culture.
Well, you make me sound like I ran away from the United States.
No, you were married.
I was the Moscow correspondent of the Washington Post, and I wrote my first book there.
Yeah, okay.
Left the United States to make me sound like an immigrant.
No, I didn't mean to say you were on the run or you were defecting or anything. I apologize. But my point simply was you were put in a position where, because your husband was the Washington correspondent for the Moscow correspondent for the Washington Post, you were out of the country for a couple of years at a really interesting period in this country's history. But it also yanked you out of something and gave you a perspective that few people get.
Well, it was a very crucial point in my life and forming my ideas. Basically, in Moscow at that time, it's not true today, of course. But there wasn't any entertainment except really great music and ballet and theater, because the entertainment culture didn't exist then. They had TV, of course, but it was all endless speeches by party hacks, and no person in his right mind, Russian or American, was interested in watching Soviet TV. So what happened was, and this was true of Russian intellectuals as well, what happened is that you had to fall back. You were forced, because there was no rock music. Well, there was on pirated tapes, but you were forced to go to concerts by great musicians and listen to great classical music. You were forced to go to the plays of Chekhov. You were forced to go to adaptations of the novels of Dostoevsky. And you were forced to talk in little Russian apartments and discuss books, both Western books and Russian books, with Russian intellectuals. I was ripped out of the entertainment culture for 2 years. And being ripped out of the entertainment culture was a very interesting experience, because you realized how much of what you spent your time on was crap when you were in a society. Now, I'm not recommending this. All I'm saying is, for me, it was a revelation to be in a society where I couldn't engage in popular culture, because the popular culture was so unentertaining. And I remember, you know, I loved art then, and as a correspondent, we would go out, you know, on periodic vacations to Western Europe. You know, and I would sit in the living room and I would describe to my Russian artist friends, you know, the paintings I'd seen in the museums in Florence and what the streets looked like. And I realized for the first time how lucky I was, how we just took this cultural heritage for granted. Those people then never thought they would ever be able to travel anywhere in the West, because that was the system then. And it really did give me a new perspective.
Our guest, Susan Jacoby, author of The Age of American Unreason. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580, a pre-recorded show, so please do not call in. This book presents a very powerful argument about and critique about the state of American intellectual, cultural, political life in our times today. And let's go through some of your critique now. In the last few chapters of the book, really bring together all your points. And one of the discussions is what you call junk thought. What do you mean by junk thought, and what are some examples?
Well, by junk thought, I mean thought that's not based on any kind of evidence at all, but that's based on emotion. It's an amalgam of superstition, of non-evidence, of ignorance about science. There are so many examples of junk thought, but I'll give you just one, and I'm giving it to you because it's a controversial example, and there are many people who won't agree with it. There is an anti-vaccination movement in this country. There are people who believe, who have suffered the tragedy of having an autistic child, that autism is caused by too many vaccinations and immunizations, and specifically by a measles, mumps, and rubella shot. Now, this has been studied rigorously in countries where they can compare autism rates, which are rising all over the world, for reasons we don't know, between vaccinated and unvaccinated children. The rate of autism in vaccinated and unvaccinated children in countries where they've studied it is exactly the same. The reason that some parents have seized on this is that quite often measles vaccines are given in the second year of life. And the second year of life is when the classical symptoms of autism begin to interfere. And so they're mistaking coincidence, these two things happening in the same time frame, for causation. And it's very painful to talk about this. What happens on television is there will always be an agonized parent saying, my kid developed the first symptoms of autism after having a vaccination. And then there'll be a scientist there saying, but we've studied this in thousands of children, and there's no difference in the autism rate for vaccinated and unvaccinated children. And the moderator will say, well, that's a controversy. What they're doing is they're putting science and the parents' emotions on the same level. You can take the same thing with the evolution debate. When people put creationists on one side, creationist parent on one side, and a scientist on the other side, and it's take your pick, as though there were scientific evidence for creationism as well as for evolution. Now, this is partly a matter of scientific ignorance. These are just two examples of junk thought. Endless stuff about Americans believe overwhelmingly in miracles and you know, whether science shows it to be true or not. These things are partly just a matter of scientific ignorance. 20% of Americans believe that the sun revolves around the earth. Now, you can't, you know, it's not a matter of opinion. The sun does not revolve around the earth. So that basic science, scientific ignorance coupled with bad education, we are among the developed countries of the world. We are 14th out of 28 or 15-year-olds in science. Bad education, coupled with the media's tendency to treat all opinions as being equal. It's exactly like saying, so-and-so says that 2 plus 2 equals 5. But mathematicians, of course, still say that 2 plus 2 equals 4. The truth isn't always equidistant between two points. Sometimes something is just plain wrong, and the fact that a lot of people believe it to be right doesn't make it so.
Susan Jacoby, one of the really interesting parts of your book that towards the end was when you discuss what's happened to the ability of human beings to have conversations, and then how this relates to our ability to have friendships. And this really goes very closely, I believe, to the question of just human happiness and how successful society is. What's your discussion there?
Well, conversation I'm glad you asked that question. You have to see people face-to-face to have conversation. Now, I will follow up the obvious query about that. Conversation, like reading, is one of the pillars of intellectual life, throwing around ideas, back and forthing. And I hear people saying, what about the chat rooms? What about the internet? Well, this is something I can speak with some authority on now. I have my own blog at the Washington Post and Newsweek. It's called The Secularist Corner. I'm also a contributor to a panel that the Washington Post and Newsweek have called On Faith, in which there's a question this week about whether faith can make you well, whether faith can make you healthy. The problem is sometimes the comments are very intelligent, but a lot of what goes on in email and in commenting on blogs bears no resemblance to conversation. It's just people stating their own point of view, whether they can back it up with any facts at all. It's every taxi driver who ever said, I could write a great book if only I had the time. Well, they can on the Internet. And there's something else about the conversation on the Internet which, far from being good and raising the level, lowers the level, and that is its anonymity. At the On Faith blog, I don't have anything to do with it, but I know that they, you know, if they get severe anti-Semitic comments or severe anti-Muslim comments, things like that, or obscenities, they remove those, you know, entries from the website. And very often people complain bitterly about censorship and they're not having their First Amendment rights. And I wrote a whole entry on Faith about this, saying that they completely misunderstand the First Amendment. The First Amendment is about standing up for what you believe and standing up for it, and you can't be punished for it. Anonymous letters, so to speak, which is what most of the Internet is not, it has nothing to do with the First Amendment because it has no consequences. Many of the people in Internet chat rooms and on blogs are expressing opinions that they would be terribly ashamed if their boss or their friend or their lover or their child knew that they were talking in that way. And the fact that people are allowed to present, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't be, but what they're allowed to do is say anything they want. Whereas if you write a letter to the editor of a newspaper, they're going to check the facts. And if you say that something happened in the year 2000 that actually happened in the year 1800, it's not going to go. But on a blog, you see statements like that every day. So I don't call that conversation.
You know, you see people, when I walk around cities or I'm on college campuses, which I often am, between classes, people almost all or large numbers are on cell phones talking to someone else. And it's sort of ironic, your suggestion, that all this
I hear all too much of that cell phone conversation.
but it's ironic that your argument is that all this conversation is leading to less sort of real human interaction.
Well, I think conversation is exactly like reading in that it has to have time, really, to develop. One of the things about email, for instance, and it's true to some extent of cell phones, too. Your minutes are clicking away. One of the things about email is it tends to be a very factual, informational form of communication. There are people who write discursive emails, but for the most part, email is nothing like the letters which people used to write. It serves a different purpose. It makes it easier to check in with people, but in a way, you don't have very long, you know, leisurely exchanges with people on email, because that's not what the purpose of email is. And most of us are too busy dumping the email we don't want to have time to spend much, you know, on conversation via email.
And in the book, too, when you're going through your critique of what's going on with public life today, a really interesting discussion comparing presidents like and political figures like FDR and John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy's very famous speech on the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, in which he was invoking Greek poetry to a popular crowd, to a large crowd of people. And just your notion that sort of reference to our intellectual heritage and revelation that a politician actually has a fairly advanced education, is well read, is something we'd be much less likely to see today. Do you think that's a function of our current White House resident, or do you think that's a general rule?
No, it's general. I've often been asked, do I think George W. Bush is responsible for the dumbing down of America? And I absolutely say no. He's a symptom of the dumbing down of America. Somebody as ignorant and proud of it as George Bush would really, I think we've had bad presidents, but I don't think we've ever had, certainly in the era in which words have been recorded regularly, we've never had a president as badly spoken as George Bush. George Bush's attitude toward anything intellectual is shameful. But let's talk about the level of public speech for a change. We have had an outstanding public speaker in this presidential primary campaign. It's Barack Obama. I'm not now referring to to the content of what he says, but he is an outstanding public speaker, a real throwback, in fact, to previous generations of political orators. And what happened during the primary? One of the things that Hillary and Bill Clinton tried to do, which really shocked me, because Bill Clinton is a pretty good speaker himself, is that they tried to suggest that just being a good speaker alone made Obama an elitist. In some way, that being a good speaker, using your native language well and effectively, was in opposition to practical action, that you could either be a good speaker or have practical solutions, that there was something antagonistic between the two. And that is the essence of anti-intellectualism. It is a very subliminal message. But the idea, the suspicion of somebody who talks too well, that is really at the heart of a kind of anti-intellectual attack, which I was frankly surprised that the Clintons used. But Obama is much better spoken than most of the recent presidential candidates we've had. The last really great orator we had as a president was John Kennedy, who was preceded as a great orator by Franklin D. Roosevelt. And not all of our presidents have been great orators, but they didn't try to dumb things down by constantly referring to folks and dropping their G's in crowds where they thought people dropped their G's. I'm knowing this, I'm knowing that, I'm happy to be visiting you folks down here. And so I think that the climate of the last 8 years is just a symptom of where we are, and it's not a cause.
Susan Jacoby, in your book also, you go after the state of higher education, what students who go through an undergraduate program, what sort of education they're receiving, what they're learning. And you're quite critical of the tendency, the trend towards having courses in popular culture and popular entertainment. Can you explain what your thinking is?
Well, I don't think this is a major factor in anti-intellectualism. I think we need to think about education long before college is the most important things in terms of intellectual life. But courses in popular culture, courses in deconstructing movies like Friday the 13th, which the students at Virginia Tech University, where that terrible shooting took place, where the shooter was in that course, and some of the students were disturbed by him and had mentioned him to their teacher. But what I was amazed by is that anybody was actually getting course credit for a course studying Friday the 13th. My objection to courses in popular culture is that there's only so much time in a college year. If kids have gotten good grounding in science and literature and history, well, fine. But given the fact that half of kids between 18 and 25 can't find a rock on a map, I think that we can do better using college time than studying Friday the 13th. And by the way, I think anybody who gets to college without knowing how to deconstruct Friday the 13th must be a true idiot and doesn't belong in college. It's about girls getting slashed up. That's what it's about.
On that note, Susan Jacoby, I regret our time has passed. We've got to go now. Susan Jacoby, the author of The Age of American Unreason. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters, and thank you very much for joining us today, Ms. Jacoby.
I enjoyed it very much.
All right, have a good day.
Bye.